Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight.
First of all, we are so excited that these guidelines are finally out there in summary form. The publication is coming soon. The last guideline from the ACR was in 1999, and thus this is a large accomplishment, and I'm very proud of the organization for doing this.
Today, Dr. Chachachian and Delara joined the podcast to discuss 2025 guideline summary of the clinical treatment and management of systemic lupus erythematosus in this PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative supporters.
Hello, I'm Dr. Yashar Chachachian, Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine and Director of the Stanford Lupus Clinic and the Associate Program Director for the Rheumatology Fellowship Program in the Division of Immunology and Rheumatology at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California.
Hello, I'm Maria Delara, Professor and Chief of the Division of Rheumatology and Director of the Lupus Clinic and Rheumatology Clinical Research Center in the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco.
Thank you for joining me, Maria.
Thank you, Yashar. It's great to be here with you today.
Maria, I know you were a member of the core leadership team involved with the development of these new ACR SLE guidelines. Can you tell us a little bit more about the development process for these guidelines?
I would be happy to do that. First of all, we are so excited that these guidelines are finally out there in summary form. The publication is coming soon. The last guideline from the ACR was in 1999, and thus this is a large accomplishment, and I'm very proud of the organization for doing this. In a nutshell, the way this worked was there was a core leadership team that I had the privilege of being a part of. We had a separate literature review team, and then we had a separate voting panel. And the constituents of all of these groups included adult and pediatric rheumatologists, two dermatologists, a physician assistant, and patients living with lupus. There was a separate patient panel that met, and then two of the patients on the panel sat on the voting panel and had direct input into the final recommendations. And I'd also like to mention that the American College of Rheumatology utilizes grade methodology. And what they do is perform a comprehensive literature review that informs the recommendations. And the evidence is graded either strong recommendation or a conditional recommendation in the end. Strong recommendation basically means that the majority of people would choose that recommendation and only a minority would not. And there's a higher level of evidence underlying that recommendation. Whereas conditional is a little bit more of a gray area. It's not so clear cut and there's more room for shared decision making. And importantly, when you look at this guideline, there are 35 total recommendations. Only three of them are strong recommendations.
Thank you so much, Maria. I think that was a really helpful summary of how the guidelines were developed and the inclusion of both adult and pediatric rheumatologists as well as dermatologists really highlights the broad scope of providers involved in developing these guidelines and really reinforces why these are applicable to both pediatric and adult lupus.
Absolutely, Yashar. And I would love to hear your take on the guidelines and what you think are the major messages from this guideline.
Thank you. Yeah, I think this is really timely. I mean, this is a really exciting time in terms of SLE treatment. There's a lot of new developments happening, and this really encapsulates sort of where we are in 2025 in terms of how we approach the treatment of SLE. You know, key overarching principles that I think are really emphasized in these guidelines are really being more proactive rather than reactive in our approach to SLE, and that, you know, really time is of the essence. A lot of damage that occurs in SLE is early on. And so if we're really reacting to that and sort of adding medications later on, we're really, not doing due justice to our patients. Also, we have a lot of higher quality data emerging now in terms of more targeted therapies that mechanistically go after some of the underpinnings specific to SLE. So the more we can use these treatments use medications more smart, in more smart manner, and sort of maximize efficacy over treatment-related adverse effects, I think, is really important. And so, yeah, I think this really dovetails nicely with some of the important concepts of like treat to target that are changing the way we approach SLE management.
I agree completely. And just adding on to the great points that you made, the three strong recommendations in this guideline are the following. The first is that hydroxychloroquine is our foundational medication that every patient with lupus should be on unless there is a contraindication. Yeah. And as you know, the contraindications are extremely rare. And we recommend a dose of 5 milligrams per kilogram of actual body weight. And just to make sure that once a year, there is retinal toxicity screening by an ophthalmologist with validated tools. Number two, we emphasize glucocorticoid tapering. And the recommendation is to taper glucocorticoids to a dose of less than or equal to 5 milligrams a day, and preferentially to come completely off, because as you know, there is no safe dose of glucocorticoids. And that's a paradigm shift. And I want to hear your take on that as well. But just the third one is that we want to treat active disease early. And that's what you just spoke about, this concept of treat to target and to intervene early with our immunosuppressive therapies, both conventional and our targeted biologic therapies. Yashar, I'd love to hear what you have to say about those points.
Thank you, Maria. I think you encapsulated it really well. I you know, fully support these sort of guiding principles for the management of SLE. I think we certainly have a lot of new exciting medications for lupus, and so it's tempting to sort of think of them as potentially replacing hydroxychloroquine, but really that's not the case. We have a lot of good data over many years that hydroxychloroquine really should be foundational and remain that way for patients with SLE. And so it should really, only if there's retinal toxicity or truly intolerance to it, shouldn't be used. Otherwise, it should be continued. And, you know, as you're well aware, there's mortality benefit to hydroxychloroquine that's been shown in multiple cohorts. And there's data that in patients even sustained remission who come off of hydroxychloroquine have higher rates of flare. And so I think these guidelines emphasize that they should remain on the treatment. And like you said, I think it's an outdated concept that there are low doses of steroids that can be safe. I think certainly it's safer than a higher dose, but a lot of the general toxicities we associate with glucocorticoids, and particularly even damage, which we're trying to avoid in lupus, independent of disease activity, just from glucocorticoids can happen at even what we traditionally consider modest doses. So I think, again, really from the beginning, when you're seeing a patient with lupus, thinking how are we going to get their steroid dose down? And then it nicely sort of correlates with earlier adoption of steroid-sparing therapies, which is the third principle.
Absolutely. And just to add on to that as well, one of the other strategies that we mentioned in the guideline is to use glucocorticoids for flares in a certain way, right? That we're recommending using pulse IV glucocorticoids first up front and then starting at a lower dose of oral glucocorticoids. And that is the same strategy, by the way, that's in the lupus nephritis guideline. Pulse glucocorticoids and then a lower starting dose of oral glucocorticoids and then an expeditious taper within 6 months, preferably even before 6 months, down to a dose of less than equal to 5 milligrams a day and hopefully to come off completely. That's another, I think, tip, you know, for our listeners in terms of how we are using glucocorticoids in this modern era. And then I also wanted to mention that these guidelines followed specific guiding principles. And a couple that we have not mentioned yet is the importance of shared decision making and individualizing treatment choices. And our patient panel involved with this guideline emphasized this point repeatedly, the importance of having open, trusting conversations between patients living with lupus and their clinicians in a way that shared decision-making can come out and a personalized treatment regimen can be chosen for a particular patient in the context of what their needs and desires and their goals for their health are. And that came out time and time again. And our patients also mentioned issues surrounding medication toxicities and making sure that we try to limit those and also limit pill burden. That was another theme that came out from our patients living with lupus. And then another guiding principle, just to mention as well, is the importance of collaboration and care. And as you well know, many of our patients have multiple organs that are involved with lupus, whether it's the heart, whether it's the skin, the kidneys. So having a multidisciplinary approach with multiple specialists can be very helpful. Have you found that as well?
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of our patients, as you mentioned, will have multiple organs involved. These are complicated cases. You really want to have a consensus approach to management with your colleagues and have that close relationship built in. So I find that the best care is when you're having open communication, not only with your patient to build trust and to, you know, ensure adherence and that the treatment aligns with their preferences and values and is individualized to their disease state, but really, you know, coming at it in a way that you're approaching the treatment in a similar manner to colleagues, because there may be sometimes areas of slight disagreement, but finding what's most appropriate for that specific patient in a collaborative manner, I think, is the best route to success.
I completely agree. And then another recommendation that came forward is to consider tapering immunosuppressive therapies after 3 to 5 years if our patients have reached remission or low disease activity. But I have to say, from my personal practice, many of my patients have to remain on some low level of immunosuppressive medication. Of course, this is on top of hydroxychloroquine. But the idea here is that after a period of time, that 3 to 5 years, when you've reached remission or low disease activity, to begin to consider tapering back some of the immunosuppressive medications that may be leading to toxicities or side effects. At least have that conversation and think about that at every clinic visit. And of course, we would never consider tapering immunosuppressives until the glucocorticoids are tapered off. That's the first one to come off. And then we think about other agents that we could potentially begin to taper.
I wholeheartedly agree. And just to reinforce the point, what we're both saying is prednisone first, then potentially immunosuppression, but hydroxychloroquine certainly remains as the sort of bedrock medication in the background. I think areas that we still as a community can work out are, what is the rate of tapering, you know, and in some patients, what are potential markers or phenotypes where it may be more challenging to taper. But I think the 3 to 5 years is sort of in a way extrapolated in, for example, in lupus nephritis, where that's often the sort of the minimum duration where we're thinking of continuing immunosuppression after induction therapy in terms of maintenance. So I think that's in line with that approach. And so for a lot of patients, that may be a reality, but obviously everything is individualized to the specific patient.
Absolutely. One final comment I'd like to make is around one of the good practice statements, which I think is very important. And that is that it's important for us as rheumatology clinicians to screen, monitor, and treat our patients living with lupus for comorbid conditions, including cardiovascular disease. We know that our patients with lupus are at increased risk for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease and are at risk for cardiovascular death. And it's up to us to screen and treat for that, as well as keeping in mind screening and treating for osteoporosis, making sure that our patients have their appropriate vaccinations, cancer screening, lifestyle factors, all of these things we can think about and also involve our colleagues to help us manage.
Thank you, Maria, for this great discussion and recap of the lupus clinical treatment guideline updates from the American College of Rheumatology. These guidelines mark an important step forward in patient care.
And thank you, Yashar. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
And thank you to our audience for watching.
And that's today's Specialist Spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PeerDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit PeerDirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review on your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@PeerDirect.com. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, or TuneIn. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing medical news roundup and just ask, what's my Flash Briefing? Thanks today to our guest, Drs. Chachachian and Dell Arra. Join me next time for an episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.